Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's 3:25 p.m. and that is a central time. Today is October 14th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought we'd kick off with the 30-year gilt because we're coming back up towards this psychological 5% level, and the Bank of England is playing hardball. Now, part of the reason that they feel like that they have the leeway to do that is because we're talking about margin calls, and it's not like pension funds don't have assets. But I think something that's less appreciated is the extent to which pension funds have alternatives in their portfolios that can't be sold. So that's why we have this upward pressure on yields. In a liquidity crisis, you sell what you can, not what you want to. And that's exactly what's happening with UK LDI pensions. So it's not like every pension is going to be in this predicament, but a sizable number of them are. And they're going to have to solve it in a number of different ways. So some of them are going to go to their parent organizations and say, please give us more money. And or change the interval at which you give us money. Give us a year's worth of contributions now, so that we can get ourselves out of this mess. And that's perhaps the best possible scenario. But some will be unable to do that, and then they'll be forced to come up with the cash separately. And that means they'll have to sell assets that they may not want to. So this is obviously problematic. The Bank of England has said that they are very intent on getting control of inflation. Of course, the problem with inflation in Europe is that it's primarily supply driven, and in the USA, it's primarily demand driven. And I think those are, it's not like there aren't demand factors in Europe or supply factors in the USA, but the dominant one in Europe is about supply, most particularly about energy. So, as long as there's a shortage of energy, and as long as countries are paying up for it, where we're talking about really significant sums, hundreds of billions of dollars, or euros or pounds, to plug the hole in the public finances, and more particularly, the finances of the public. So, this is going to be exceptionally expensive, and in normal circumstances, it would be normal to anticipate that. Bond yields should rise in that event. If the Bank of England isn't willing to just simply print the money and buy the bonds and artificially suppress the bond yield, then yields should rally. That's exactly what's happening. So they said that they're going to try and defend the 5% level, and that's equivalent to yield curve control. But then they've also said they're going to end their assistance today. What it means is that there are going to be problems arising, and the resolve of the Bank of England is going to be tested into just how much pain are they willing to accept. But I think it's important to highlight that part of the reason why we've had this problem in the first place is because of quantitative easing. And it is supremely ironic that Ben Bernanke has been given the Nobel Prize for Economics because he had, we're going to say the courage, but had the temerity to introduce quantitative easing in the first place. And as early as 2009 and 10, people were talking about this being a transfer of wealth from savers to speculators. And that's exactly what we've had over the course of the last decade, because exceptionally low interest rates and exceptionally low bond yields, that if we just simply look at the 30-year, and many pension funds equivalent or have equivalent durations of about 30 years, then yields trended downwards from 2009 until 2020, and it greatly flattered the performance of the bond sector, but as each new bond was bought, the yield that was captured was lower and lower. So this problem with undercapitalized pension funds has been compounding. They have been entirely dependent on asset price appreciation, whether that is in the bonds they own, in the stocks they own, or the alternative assets they own. So what it's effectively done has turned pension funds away from a compounding strategy just by buying bonds and holding on to them and compounding over a long period of time all of those coupons, and instead turned them into speculators. And it turned everyone else into speculators as well. And therefore, the types of assets that have done best in the last 14 years are speculative assets. That's not surprising. So we can look at the Nasdaq over the same period, and it's really done very little but go up. But now it is coming down. And this has been an acute decline since the beginning of this year. It has repeatedly encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average, and now it has broken down through the 1,000-day moving average. This has been an exceptionally volatile week, where we had a significant drop yesterday, and then a rebound to create an upside key reversal. The key to the key is follow through and size. Well, it was a sufficiently large move to pressure me at least into closing out my short position, and I don't feel particularly good about that in here today. I'll be encouraged, I think, to reopen it if I see prices breaking down once more, but I do prefer to short into rallies in a downtrend. And today's move certainly was not follow through, there's still downward pressure here, and investors are pricing in the potential that the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates by 75 basis points, or potentially even 100 basis points in November, and then again in December. So, one of the factors that contributed to the outperformance of speculative assets over the last decade was not only that the discount rate was declining, but that it practically disappeared. But now we have a discount rate that is rising and doing so rapidly. What I find especially interesting is the time lag, because I was asked by the National Association of Independent Money Managers to speak at their conference next week, and they were asking me, well, what was it that I saw that led me to start shorting in March, and why was I ahead of the curve in that regard? And I was very simply saying that we saw the Nasdaq breaking down, we saw speculative assets starting to roll over, then we saw resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average, and that's a really significant signal that it was at least going to come down and test the 1,000-day moving average. So that was the reason why I started shorting, but also because I looked at everything that's been going on in the last 2 years, and I think there are a couple of different parallels. The first is with the chip sector, and I think this is a parallel similar to the late 1990s. So back in 1999, we had fear about Y2K. It massively accelerated the demand cycle. And then there was a huge response in terms of production. So we had huge investment in new supply at exactly the same time that demand evaporated. Then they had to sell their production for whatever they could get for it in order to keep the factories open. And semiconductors went through a 14-year bear market. So then in 2020, we had the fear of the pandemic, and we had massive money creation and a real drive to adopt cloud solutions. But of course, if you're going to have a whole cloud infrastructure, it's also implying that you're going to have the vast majority of your workforce working remotely, which means huge demand for PCs, tablets, networking equipment, furniture, and then also for database and cloud infrastructure and software. So these are all chip dependent, and we saw a phenomenally large move in the semiconductors index from the low in March of 2020, around 1265, the index went to 4000. That's a phenomenal acceleration, and it's over. And now the market is pulling back and doing so in a really dynamic manner. So it's exceptionally likely that this is going to look exactly like what happened in at the early part of the 2000s, that we're going to have a big decline and then a couple of years of very subpar earnings that are going to contribute to a deep decline. So it's, I think, quite likely that we're going to see it coming all the way down to the upper side of the base formation, which will be somewhere around 1,000 or 1,500. And in the worst case scenario, it will unwind the entire bull market, and that would take it down to 200. That's a 90% decline from where we are right now, and that is really dependent on just how deep the unfolding recession is going to be. So that's one of the clearest parallels that we have. Then let's just look at the S&P 500 right ahead of the credit crisis, because I do think that there are some significant parallels. And most particularly, we did not have the acceleration higher in 2006. The market certainly did well, and it continually bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average. And then it dropped downwards and broke the sequence of lower rally highs, excuse me, for higher reaction lows, rebounded, made a new high and failed, and then pulled back below the 200-day moving average again, and then failed, and then encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average and dropped again. So by that stage, we were in a clear bear market. And this is very similar to what we had in March of this year. And I also find it especially interesting the time intervals here, that we had a dip in March, but it wasn't, we had the market encountering resistance at the end of March, and this time it was in the middle of May. So there's only a 6 month interval, excuse me, 6 week interval between these two instances of resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. And you can see here that I've posted the counter trend rallies, and we've had 10% rallies, 14% rallies, a nine, give or take, a 9.3% rally. At the bottom, there was a 27% counter trend rally. That was the largest counter trend rally we'd seen, and it was after an exceptionally large acceleration on the downside. Now let's just zoom back out, go over here, and look at what's happening right now. We've had resistance in the region of the moving average twice now, and now we're getting resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The problems that are evolving in the bond market, where we have an increasingly large proportion of the yield curve in the USA that is inverted. So the 20-year is higher than the 30-year, the 10-year is higher than the 30-year. In fact, everything from 2 years forward is higher than the 30-year, and the 2 year is higher than the 5 year, the 5 year is higher than the 10-year. And these are significant inversions. Usually, by the end of the cycle, the entire yield curve is inverted. Now, that could easily be achieved by the 20-year simply coming down a bit, but that's not the most liquid part of the curve. Now, it's obviously representative of liquidity being drained out of the system. The issues that they have in Europe are very much tied to the war in Ukraine, but also that growth never really got going there, and that now the leverage in pension funds is going to start to become problematic. Now, I've got a couple of charts that I think are especially useful in this regard. If we look at research from the Pew Trusts.org, we can see that back in 1959, the vast majority of pension funds held bonds and not much else. By the time we got around to 1999, they held a lot more stock. In 2009, they had about 19% in alternatives, and now they have 27%. So they don't hold nearly as many bonds as they used to. And there's a good reason for that. So we can definitely say that there is a direct correlation between the compression in government bond yields and the willingness of pensions to hold them. So they have basically swapped the security of compounding in government bonds for the better returns from risk assets, but in doing so, they've accepted either volatility or liquidity concerns. And when you've got 27% of your portfolio in alternatives that can't be sold overnight, then you're leaving the fund open to a significant liquidity issue and a revaluation or a mark-to-market environment. Alternative assets haven't really begun to be reset yet because funds aren't under pressure to do so. They come under pressure to do so when other assets have fallen and when they go through their revaluation cycle. Now, the revaluation cycles don't happen overnight, and their fiscal year is when they report things. So they reported their fiscal year, which ended in April, at the end of one of the most impressive years for pension funds ever, where in 2021, absolutely everything went up. There was a huge swell of interest into a market that had already been the subject of a flurry of activity before the pandemic. There was people falling over themselves to invest in alternative assets in 2019. It looked bubbly to me back then. And then we had the pandemic, and the value of private assets multiplied and then multiplied again. And now with liquidity coming out of the market, then those prices are going to experience significant drawdowns. But it's not going to be immediate. We're going to start to see pension funds that are going to go bust because they do not have the liquid assets that they said they did, or they're going to be caught short by these margin calls. And then they'll have to sell illiquid assets. Now, some of those assets will go for fire sale prices, and the people who eventually get to buy them are going to come out of this in a very positive position eventually. But in the short term, it's problematic. So I thought that was a really interesting chart because it's representative of public pension funds. And that's 29 million people. But because they're public pension funds, it means that they're involved in, or they're supporting people like teachers, policemen, firemen, sanitation workers, bureaucrats. So when those sorts of pensions start going under, then they generally have to be rescued with higher taxes. And that's really quite deflationary. Then let's look at the global picture, and I thought this was also an interesting chart. So we have the CPIB in Canada has 50% of their assets in alternatives, and China's Investment Corp is at around 40-something percent. ABP in the Netherlands is right here at 35%. The Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, 37%. Now, some of these are sovereign wealth funds, so they're not under pressure to ever sell. Pension funds need to have income. So they will sell eventually, and or they will be looking for cash flows from their assets. And if those cash flows deteriorate, well, then those assets are basically worthless to them. Then one of the most active of the public funds is CalPERS, and they've got 28%, almost 29% in alternatives. So it is important, I think, to look at the pensions, but then also to look at the sovereign wealth funds. Sovereign wealth funds have the leeway to sit through declines, but their chief executives might get fired somewhere along the way. But the point is that they don't generally report until the end of the fiscal year, which would take us up to April, May of next year, before we could potentially see a serious mark-to-market event. Or we're going to see it earlier because people will start anticipating it. But most certainly, the higher yields go, the more risk there is, not just of a liquidity crisis, but also of a solvency crisis. And that's where the real risk is. Now, when we go back then and look at the stock markets. So the S&P 500 is right now in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And if it's going to find support, it's going to have to do it soon. We have a short-term oversold condition, but no real evidence just yet that support has been found despite the pop on the upside we had yesterday. Microsoft is right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average and did follow through on the upside, or at least was in positive territory in here today. And that's not quite true. So this positive figure that it's showing is obviously for after hours. When we think about where we're going here, the risk assets did best in the low interest rate environment. So it's therefore reasonable to accept or to expect that risk assets will not do as well when liquidity is being tightened. And that suggests that the largest companies in the world are going to come under pressure. And perhaps the company that did best from the liquidity provision is Tesla. And the share continues to decline here. It's come from 300 to 200 in the space of 4 weeks. So this has been really quite an acute acceleration of the downtrend. It's now back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So Tesla does make money, but they're definitely having problems manufacturing their 4680 battery. And people pulling it apart are highlighting that there's not nearly as much different about this new battery that was hailed as a massive technological breakthrough 2 years ago as was initially advertised. And they're having difficulties ramping up production of these batteries in Germany. So not only are they not as good as they said they would be, but they're having difficulty making them because they're technologically more difficult to manufacture. And then the bigger question is about competition and about resource availability, because lithium prices continue to march higher. And this, I think, is something that is difficult. When we think about the costs here, lithium was up 10,000 renminbi in here today. So this is 537,500 per metric ton. And that's expensive. There's about 8 kilograms of lithium in every EV battery. And then you've got copper and molybdenum and manganese. And of course, then you need to have more steel, and it has to be higher quality steel because these cars are so heavy. So these are significant issues, and the cost of manufacturing is not going to come down. One thing that has been a factor in renewable energy has been the willingness to forego profitability in service to the capturing of market share. That's not feasible when you have a higher discount rate. So now you have electric vehicle companies that are on the cusp of going bust, or they're going to need additional capital. So Tesla is not the only company that's under pressure. NIO is probably further along in its battery manufacturing, and it's still trending downwards. Lucid Group has got a big brother in the form of Saudi Arabia, but the share is trending downwards. And XPeng is another one of these Chinese companies that's trending downwards. And there are 240 electric vehicle companies in China. And that might not be exactly the right figure, but I know for a fact it's in excess of 200. They're not all going to succeed, and they're not all going to be able to gain access to the limited supply of battery metals. So the potential for the EV sector to grow at a sufficiently quick rate to justify the valuations is pretty impossible. The reality is that nobody wants a new mine. And people living in places like Bolivia and Argentina are very leery of using scarce water resources in a critically water-deprived area to mine lithium. So this isn't an easy topic to get over. And then you have this very politicized environment with oil. So you have the Biden administration basically penalizing drilling in the USA and then castigating Saudi Arabia that they're not drilling more. And the rest of the world is basically saying to the US, well, why don't you just do it yourself? And this, I think, is one of the big contradictions. And the problem, I think, in the market today is that the markets are festooned with contradictions. That and the most important of them is that a pension fund can be as risk-free when it holds only 20% of bonds as it would have been when it held 90% in bonds. And that's just not true. So this is, I think, seriously problematic. And the electric vehicle sector has been at one of the biggest beneficiaries of the low interest rate risk on environment, and it's been forgiven for not being exceptionally profitable or being able to scale up. And you have companies like Ford and GM. Well, they've basically been told, and I think it's important to highlight that they're favored by the US government because their operations are in Michigan. And Michigan's a swing state. And they're controlled by their unions. And the unions are controlled by the Democrat Party. So the Democrats have basically told them they have to go EV. And these companies, they've basically given up on producing sedans. They're going to be producing pickup trucks and electric vehicles. And the reality is that nobody outside of the city is going to buy an electric vehicle. And they're still going to make their money from pickup trucks, and they may not be able to reach their supply goals of building electric vehicles because of the cost, because the ability to bring down costs is heavily dependent on access to resources. So in order for them to survive, they're going to have to come full circle. They started off with their own iron foundries or steel foundries. and then they sold them off. So it in order to survive, electric vehicle companies are going to have to go off and buy the mines, or they're going to have to give the capital to mining companies to actually deliver a custom supply to the manufacturer. And that's going to be exceptionally capital intensive. So the capital light business model that has been propagated for the last 30 years is over if they're going to even come close to achieving their goal of producing electric vehicles. What's also important here is that oil prices still have a sequence of lower rally highs and have been down now for 4 of the last 5 days. So sometimes it's about supply, but other times it's really about demand. Most of the time it's about supply. In a rising market, people are mostly concerned about supply. How much will OPEC produce? How much will non-OPEC produce? And in what volumes? And in what will it be sweet or heavy oil that'll get produced? And how will it be refined? It's all about supply. But at economic turning points, it's really more about demand. And we're seeing recessions starting now in Europe and coming around the world not too soon afterwards, because global liquidity is tightening up in a big way. Let's just look at the central bank balance sheets, because I think this is a meaningful trend. The index peaked because the dollar bottomed. And now we have central banks actively reducing the size of their balance sheets, and the dollar is still strong. So this index now is trending downwards. And it's already lopped at, let's just put a real figure on it, 33 down to 29. So $4 trillion off the size of global balance sheets for central banks. And it's still coming down. The dollar index has had two downside key reversals in the last 3 weeks. And the last one was yesterday, and there was no downside follow-through in here today. I hear quite a lot of commentary about the potential for a new Plaza Accord, and that the dollar is stronger today than it has been in years. Well, it's certainly true that it's stronger than it has been in years. And the negative repercussions of siphoning at liquidity out of the global market is, I think, not yet fully priced into stocks. And the dollar is still advancing, and it's still holding the 110 level, which is the short-term sequence of higher reaction lows. And we've had some downward dynamics, and certainly those have also corresponded with downside key reversals. But so far, they haven't been enough to do anything other than check the advance. But the other thing with the Plaza Accord is that it was in 1985, and the dollar had been exceptionally strong for 5 years before it. And the Japanese economy was reaching the peak of its growth, and the yen was too weak. And what the Plaza Accord was really about was not so much about devaluing the dollar, but encouraging countries like Japan and Germany to allow their currencies to appreciate relative to it. And multilateral intervention like that always works, but it does take a little bit of time, and we're just not there yet. Because the dollar is strong, but where is going to be willing to allow their currency to appreciate not just a little, but by 30 or 40%? And when we think about the candidates, China is actively devaluing their currency. Japan is dealing with a significant trade deficit right now because of high oil prices. So, and they're actively devaluing the yen. And the yen was at another new low in here today. This is a really clear accelerating trend up towards 150. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see some support for the yen coming through at 150, but we're definitely going to have to see evidence of a blink by the people's excuse me, the Bank of Japan. Then China's renminbi is depreciating, the euro is depreciating, and they're doing so for good reason. It's not like Europe is actively devaluing the euro for competitive advantage. They just have a really difficult economic environment right now, and they're spending money like water. And the Germans are a lot more amenable today to the idea of joint issuance of debt. And they've never been willing to do that before. But it just goes to show that what Europe needs is a crisis to force cohesion. And a war on the border, and the reality that living in an illusion that an autocratic government is going to be your friend indefinitely, well, that's just gone now. So Europe is going to be building a lot more nuclear reactors, and they're going to be a lot keener to look at the potential for energy independence. And it's not about the environment any longer. It's about simple geopolitics, that they will no longer be or allow themselves to be held hostage to energy. Now, that's going to take a couple of years, but it means they'll be importing a lot more LNG, they'll be building a lot more nuclear reactors, and they'll double down then on their own protectionism version, which would be to insist that their trading partners also adopt their environmental standards. And uranium is still under pressure here. The problem right now is that it's very difficult to walk in and buy because there's still significant potential for contagion in the event that the alternative asset sector starts to get marked to market. Then people will have to sell what they have, not what they want to, in order to raise money. And there will be fire sales. So I think that's one of the most particular risks to rushing in to buy. I thought that this was a very interesting chart as well for alternative assets. We've had phenomenal growth in the price of secondhand watches. I know a young guy who did very well, got a nice bonus in the UK in June of this year. And the first thing he did is he went out and he bought the watch that he's always wanted. And he paid, give or take, around the peak value for it. And now he's saying, well, maybe if I had waited and it's the price is at today, I wouldn't have made the purchase. And I still like having the watch. But coming down from 37 to 29,000 in the space of 4 months is a big correction. And it's not simply because there are more watches, but rather that there's more sellers and that liquidity is draining out of the market. When I talk to my daughter, and she has her little business online where she's developed her own species and is sells slots so that people can draw their own with different characteristics. She was saying that the market was way more active and that the prices that were being achieved within the little art community that she's in were much higher 6 months ago than they are today, and that a number of these little marketplaces have basically evaporated because people stopped making money from them, so they just stopped doing it. And I think this is really just the thin end of the wedge that we're going to start to see asset prices coming down. And this is most especially true when we think about the kinds of assets that everybody owns. So, property prices have surged over the last couple of years, but since March, we've had of 2020, the Shiller National Index went from around 215 to 307. So that's a really significant move. And I think it's less about inflation now. Like when we think, for example, I thought this was another interesting chart, that supply-driven factors were really significant in 2021, but the supply factors are deteriorating. So supply-driven inflation isn't going to be as important in the next 6 or 7 months because the shipping rates have come down, the queues at ports have come down, companies are talking about selling more and discounting and more inventory. So this is obviously something that's important because it's going to at least moderate some of the inflationary pressures. But then you're going to have a situation where wages have gone up, but some of the supply-driven inflation figures will have moderated. That means people will have more cash to spend. And then you're going to have the demand portion of inflation get worse. Our people will have more leeway, they'll spend more. When people have more money, they'll spend more. I think this is one of the more important factors. Now, one thing that people are talking about is that the jolts have started to come back down. So this is one of the factors that people were saying contributed to inflation. But I don't think that this makes a lot of sense. When you think about the massive excess of available jobs, I think that that's more to do with companies trying to position themselves to grow. So if you think you're going to grow a lot, well, then you're going to advertise, you're going to hire people, you're going to put out job or ask for job applicants so that if you do grow, well, then you'll be able to hire more people. And I think it's quite clear that sentiment is starting to deteriorate, and it's probably deteriorated quite a bit already. And CEO sentiment is at a very deep low level. So I think that's an additional consideration that the CEO sentiment is at lows we haven't seen for years. And that would suggest that if your CEO believes that it's not a great time, then you're going to cancel some of those job or the hiring strategy that you might have had. And that's why the jolts are rolling over. It does not mean that it's going to have anything to do with inflation. In fact, what it means is that instead, investors and CEOs are more worried about a recession and talking about cutting jobs. So you had bank earnings in here today, and Morgan Stanley basically came out and said that they're going to be firing people. They might not be firing a lot of people, but they will be firing people. JP Morgan's earnings came out and they were a bit better than expected because they made record income from interest. But their investment banking business, which is what generally makes all the money, had a terrible quarter. And it's just worth reminding ourselves that banks are liquidity providers. So when banks are not doing well, then that tells us that liquidity is not doing well. So, when we think about the let me just say the regional banks index. So this is not the the kinds of banks that are involved in investment banking, and much more representative of the real economy. Well, it's not going up. It has not yet broken down. And this is also representative of the still reasonable health of the consumer. Usually, if you're going to fire people, what you do first is you stop hiring people. And that's what the decline in the JOLTS is telling us. And then you see how things are going to go, and then you will start not replacing people. And when people stop voluntarily at quitting, and the number of people who were voluntarily quitting was exceptionally high in 2021 and early 2022. Well, that solved a problem for companies that weren't going to hire anymore. But when people are worried that they won't be able to find another job, they stop quitting. And then that forces the hands of companies. They have to start firing people. Now, let's just think about Cathie Wood's group of companies and all of those smaller companies that hired lots of people, then are in the process of firing people. I think there's been something like 40,000 people fired from the smaller branch of the tech sector over the course of the last year. And the ARK Innovation ETF is breaking down to new lows. So this is obviously clearly evident of dependence on Tesla to flatter performance. But then we should look at the darlings of the tech sector over the last few years. And Shopify is barely steady and it's still trending downwards overall. Etsy has been also one of the big beneficiaries of spending in the pandemic period, and now it is encountering resistance in the region of both the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving average. But I would say one of the companies that have done best is Lululemon. And I will say that I only say this from personal experience that a couple of years ago, when Mrs. Tracy was playing tennis, she was buying Adidas and she was buying the brand from Serena Williams. Whereas now, her team, every single person on the team wears Lululemon. And several of the teams she's been playing are wearing exactly the same outfits as they are. So it's been exceptionally popular. Now, they do make good stuff, and it is very well liked, and they've got a very loyal consumer base, but it's not cheap. So when Lululemon breaks downwards, then that's going to also be an indicator for the health of the consumer because people are willing to throw around $150, $200 on a top or a pair of leggings, and they're willing to do that when they're flush with cash. But when they're not flush with cash, well, they're going to be less inclined to do that kind of thing. So I think we're in an interesting environment right now because prices continue to deteriorate, and yet we still have pops on the upside like we had yesterday, and we still have people that want to buy the dip, and there's a lot of enthusiasm because there's still a lot of money floating around. But that continues to suggest that we're not at the end of this yet. And CPI has been above 8% for 6 consecutive months now. So central banks have every incentive to continue to tighten until unemployment starts to rise. And we're just not there yet. And The yield curve spread is the most reliable lead indicator for future recessions that we have, and it is sharply negative at a negative 47 basis points, which is similar to what it was in early 2000 and in 1989. So I think that we're not yet at the point where asset prices are going to start getting marked down. When we think about the mortgage rate, I think this was the inventory to sales chart that I thought was very interesting, that just inventory is up to where it was in 1990, and we haven't seen something like that in really quite some time. And then we also have excess savings, which are starting to come down, but haven't come even close to where they were at the beginning of the pandemic. But it's the mortgage payment that I think is most interesting. In 2020, your mortgage payment was 977, and today it's 2000. So your regular buyer has to come up with an extra $1,000 a month, and that's a big pay increase. So this is going to put pressure on housing prices, and we're still at a point where government finances have been flush with cash because of capital gains tax receipts. But that was because people were selling highly appreciated assets. So tax receipts boomed over the last 18 months, and you can't have that happen twice. So tax receipts in 2023 are going to disappoint. Now, it's also, I think, particularly interesting right now to look at gold and Bitcoin. I think that there are three important characteristics with gold. The first is that it does best in a negative real interest rate environment. Well, with interest rates rising rather sharply, then it's not as convincing to talk about a negative real interest rate environment being relevant. It will be relevant in future. It's not as relevant today. And then the continued strength of the dollar is weighing on the US dollar price of gold. And the big bull markets in gold happen when government spending goes wild. Well, if we see the kinds of issues with pensions and alternative assets arrive like we did in 2008, then there's going to be money printing on an epic scale, and the dollar will decline in a big way, and gold will take off. But in the meantime, the pressure is going to be on the downside. And we could see a surprise on the downside, and perhaps it come down towards $1,500. That's certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility in the event that the dollar continues to surge from here. And then Bitcoin rebounded quite impressively yesterday, and then gave up some of that advance in here today. We still can see the peak from back in 70,000 in November of last year. So I'm just going to zoom in a little. The price never got back above 20,000 today and then dropped back down. My point has been that Bitcoin's a liquidity barometer and it won't perform until we see a new swathe of new liquidity hitting the market. So it's also an indication of less risk appetite. So with liquidity tightening and less risk appetite, Bitcoin's struggling, and it could surprise on the downside because it's another alternative asset which has seen a huge swell of activity. But the difference with Bitcoin is that it's actively traded and reasonably liquid. But other illiquid asset, or excuse me, alternative assets, which are not marked to market, could easily have had the same kind of drawdown if they were. So that is where the risk is. It's in the alternative assets that people don't even know they own. But the vast majority of pension funds today are heavily weighted in private assets. And some of those private assets are worthless. Others will go through a devaluation cycle because the price of unlisted assets was exceptionally flattered by the era of quantitative easing. So they will struggle in an era of quantitative tightening. This is going to create significant buying opportunities, and the buying opportunities that will arise as a result of the impending recessions will be once in a decade in nature. So it's not the time to rush in, but certainly there will be valuation contraction and attractive valuations in the technology sector. There will be new biotechnology solutions that come out that will be life-changing and will have massive profit potential. There will be opportunities in resource-heavy, asset-heavy type of industries where they can control their costs in a rising interest rate environment. We're definitely in a more geopolitically tense environment. There's a tendency to think that because the USA has now banned the export of high-tech chips to China, that it's going to be problematic for China. But it's, I think, much more likely to be problematic for Taiwan. And as supply increases, and Taiwan Semiconductor canceled some of its investment in new capital infrastructure this week, but supply will increase because hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars are being committed in Korea, Japan, Europe, and the USA, and China to build their own. So Taiwan might still have a competitive edge in terms of the most technologically advanced chips. But the bigger question is, will they be able to differentiate sufficiently to maintain their advantage? And will that then eventually lead to China taking over Taiwan? Because at the moment, it has all the cards. In a significant bear market for semiconductors, the Taiwanese economy is going to struggle. So then that will open the door for China to be more expansionist. These are, we have to think about both the positives and the negatives. And the pull and the push in every market. This is exactly why I'm talking about looking at demand in the oil market, looking at alternative assets instead of looking at listed assets, and at the push and the pull that we have in every portfolio. And I do think that we're not at the end of the interest rate hiking cycle, that private assets are going to sell off. And that could well be the catalyst for easier monetary policy. But we're not there yet. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.